Trump addresses Congress.
If he just stood at the speaker's rostrum and read off all his list of accomplishments since January 20th, we'd be there all night.
Europe makes security plans.
They need to put the money on the table. They need to pass on the orders to the defense industry.
And an Egyptian counterproposal for Gaza.
Egypt and many other Arab states oppose the portion of Trump's plan that calls for Gazans to be relocated outside the Strip during rebuilding efforts.
Today is Wednesday, March 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Tuesday night in Washington, President Trump addressed Congress for the first time of his second term. Less than 2 months in, it's already been a very busy and tumultuous term. He's drastically changed foreign relations with allies in Europe. He's overseen the firing of thousands of federal employees and signed several executive orders which have been stopped by federal courts, citing their illegality. And after a fiery blow-up in the Oval Office last week, President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky are reportedly preparing to sign the much-debated minerals deal between their two countries. That's according to four sources familiar with the situation. Three of them said that Trump was planning to announce the agreement in his address to Congress Tuesday evening. Republicans are expecting the president to proudly and confidently tell the country and the world what he sees are his administration's accomplishments. Mike Johnson is the Speaker of the House and an ally of the president.
If he just stood at the Speaker's rostrum and read off all his list of accomplishments since January 20th, we'd be there all night. I don't expect it will go that long. He's going to give a truncated version of this. But there really is so much to celebrate.
Meanwhile, Democrats are expecting the same thing. However, they don't share the president's opinion that those accomplishments are good for the country. Pete Aguilar is a Democratic representative from California.
Tonight, we expect the president to put on a masterclass in dishonesty. We expect the president will focus not on everyday Americans, but on his friends and his ego. No matter what he says, he cannot change the damage he's done already. And the fact that his agenda is going to raise prices for everyday Americans.
The president's speech wraps up at just about the same time that this program has its first broadcast. We'll have a look at what was actually said and reaction to it on our next show. In the meantime, visit us online at voanews.com for up-to-date coverage.
Our other top story concerns the changing security landscape in Europe. After Paris, Washington, and London, the next key gathering on Ukraine is in Brussels. That's where European Union leaders meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Thursday to discuss concrete steps to boost defense spending for Ukraine and Europe's own security.
All this as the Trump administration says it has paused military aid to Kyiv and amid fears Washington's longtime support to Europe may end. But does the EU have the leadership, the means, and public support to go it alone? Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Most EU governments say they will stand by Ukraine whatever it takes, and Thursday may be one big test. On Tuesday, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen outlined a $5.840 billion plan to aid Ukraine and give EU countries financial leverage to rearm.
The real question in front of us is whether Europe is prepared to act as decisively as the situation dictates, and whether Europe is ready and able to act with speed and with the ambition that is needed.
If the Europeans want to step up to make up for the lost American aid to Ukraine, it needs to happen now. They need to put the money on the table. They need to pass on the orders to the defense industry.
Just as urgent, ramping up Europe's own defense capabilities, turning years of talk into action, as Washington appears to be pivoting away from Ukraine and possibly also from decades as Europe's top protector and ally.
It raises very big issues for the future of the European Union, frankly. And I think people in Europe are very aware of this. Is Europe going to address these challenges, whether it's on trade or on defense, in a collective way, or is it going to go its own, or a country's member states going to go their own way?
Some, like Poland, have invested heavily in rearming. Now, after years of U.S. calls to do more, others are stepping up, including Britain, Denmark, Germany, and France, where President Emmanuel Macron wants EU members to plow 3% or more of their GDP into defense. He's also floated extending France's nuclear deterrence to other European countries. France has long talked about so-called strategic autonomy, one less dependent on Washington. Analysts see a few countries leading the drive, from Poland and Germany to France and non-EU member Britain, who want a so-called coalition of the willing to send troops and monitor any future Ukraine peace deal.
Some degree of, I wouldn't say panic, but you know, really alarmed Europeans that realize that they need to stick together as much as possible. They realize that this is a historic time of crisis. And so you see the big nations sort of coming together, trying to get beyond their past divergences.
But some have shaky governments and shaky economies. Some EU countries and far-right parties are not on board, and public support for Ukraine is mixed. And it will take years for European defense investments to pay off.
It would need an effort, but it's not impossible to show the people that now we have to be serious about defense.
Some analysts describe this as a wake-up call for Europe in realizing the urgency of rearming to defend not only its territory, but its values. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
VOA's Katerina Lisanova caught up with Vice President J.D. Vance in the halls of the Capitol on Tuesday. She asked him about what kind of pressure the U.S. is applying to Russia, along with the very public pressure being applied to Ukraine.
There's a lot of pressure on Ukraine, but not much pressure on Russia. Do you expect to do maybe more sanctions on Russia or any other steps to pressure both sides if you want to have them on a negotiation table?
Well, I don't think that's right, actually. I mean, we still have a number of sanctions that are placed on the Russians. We do believe that the Russians economically are struggling because of this conflict. We do believe that it's in Russia's best interest, but also Ukraine and the United States' best interest to bring this conflict to a close. So we believe in applying pressure to everybody to stop the killing, because that's what the president's policy is, and that's what's in the best interest of the American people.
That's VOA's Katerina Lisanova speaking with Vice President J.D. Vance. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
The Vatican says Pope Francis is in stable condition and breathing with the help of supplemental oxygen after two respiratory crises a day earlier. In its late update Tuesday, the Vatican said Francis had no further respiratory episodes during a day spent praying, resting, and undergoing respiratory physiotherapy. Doctors said his prognosis remains guarded, meaning he is not out of danger.
A Hong Kong-based conglomerate has agreed to sell its controlling stake in a subsidiary that operates ports near the Panama Canal to a consortium, including BlackRock, Inc. It effectively puts the ports under American control after President Donald Trump alleged Chinese interference with the operations of the critical shipping lane. The deal will give the BlackRock consortium control over 43 ports in 23 countries.
At least three lawmakers were injured after chaos erupted in Serbia's parliament, where smoke bombs and flares were thrown. Lawmakers were scheduled to vote Tuesday on a law that would increase funding for university education, but opposition parties insisted the session was illegal and should first confirm the resignation of Prime Minister Miloš Vučević and his government. Parliament Speaker Ana Brnabić accused the opposition of being a terrorist gang and said one of the injured lawmakers was in a serious condition.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. President Trump's new 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada took effect on Tuesday, along with a doubling of duties on Chinese goods to 20%, sparking trade wars that could slam economic growth and raise prices for Americans still reeling from years of high inflation. The tariff actions look to upend nearly $2.2 trillion in annual U.S. trade with its top three trading partners. Trump declared that all three countries had failed to do enough to stem the flow of the deadly fentanyl opioid and its precursor chemicals into the U.S. The tariffs on Mexican and Canadian products could have deepened repercussions for a highly integrated North American economy that depends on cross-border shipments to build cars and machinery, refine energy, and process agricultural goods.
But very importantly, tomorrow tariffs 25% on Canada and 25% on Mexico, and that'll start. So they're going to have a tariff. So what they have to do is build their car plants, frankly, and other things in the United States, in which case they have no tariffs.
Even before Trump's tariffs announcement, U.S. data on Monday showed factory gate prices jumped to a nearly three-year high. It suggests that a new wave of tariffs could soon undercut production and slow the economy. Yael Selfin is chief economist for KPMG.
What it means is essentially twofold. The first thing is that prices will be higher. The cost of importing goods from these countries will be higher. So that is likely to be passed on to consumers in some way. And the other thing is that we're likely to see weaker activity as a result of it as well. So we're going to have weaker growth, and we're also going to see higher prices, which are likely to translate into higher interest rates than otherwise as well.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau hit back with 25% tariffs on $20.7 billion worth of U.S. imports into Canada. It includes orange juice, peanut butter, wine, spirits, beer, coffee, appliances, and motorcycles. Here's Prime Minister Trudeau.
Canada will be implementing 25% tariffs against $155 billion worth of American goods, starting with tariffs on $30 billion worth of goods immediately, and tariffs on the remaining $125 billion of American products in 21 days' time. Now, it's not in my habit to agree with the Wall Street Journal, but Donald, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum vowed retaliation as well and said she would announce Mexico's response on Sunday in Mexico City's iconic Zocalo Square. China responded immediately, announcing additional tariffs of 10 to 15% on certain U.S. imports starting March 10th and a series of new export restrictions for designated U.S. entities. Later, it said it raised complaints about the new measures with the World Trade Organization.
Trump's action sparked a global stock sell-off, with all major U.S. indexes lower and the Nasdaq falling into correction territory after European shares logged their biggest one-day loss in 6 months. Automakers, home builders, retailers, and other tariff-sensitive stocks all took hits. The tariffs were already sparking some U.S. price increases, running counter to Trump's election vow to bring down living costs for Americans.
Arab leaders endorsed an Egyptian counterproposal to U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to rebuild Gaza at a Cairo summit on Tuesday. This amid some skepticism about how it might be implemented, given the refusal by Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, to relinquish its power over the Gaza Strip. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
As Arab leaders pore over an Egyptian plan to rebuild Gaza Tuesday and an extraordinary meeting in Cairo, the Arab media is sounding a note of skepticism over how the plan might be implemented, given Hamas' insistence that it will not give up its more than 17-year reign over the Gaza Strip. Egypt's plan, which comes as a counterproposal to U.S. President Donald Trump's January plan to resettle Palestinians outside Gaza while the territory is rebuilt, calls for residents of Gaza to remain inside the territory in 7 specific locations in temporary housing while rubble is removed and demining takes place. Egypt and many other Arab states opposed the portion of Trump's plan that calls for Gazans to be relocated outside the Strip during rebuilding efforts. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi thanked President Trump for his efforts to help rebuild Gaza, adding that Egypt's suggested plan involved a temporary governing body to rule the territory. He says that Egypt is proposing a group of technocrats to run the territory during an interim period while a new Palestinian police force is trained and while efforts are made to secure funding from donors to rebuild what was destroyed. He added that Egypt would host a donors conference next month. Meanwhile, the situation in Gaza remains tense amid the possibility that conflict could erupt once again after Israel accused Hamas of using aid into the territory as a principal source of revenue for itself and halting aid shipments on Saturday. Saeed Sadek, who teaches political sociology at the Egypt-Japan University in Alexandria, tells VOA that many Arabs oppose disarming Hamas and forcing the group to relinquish power to rebuild Gaza.
Basically, this summit will discuss how to marginalize, sideline Hamas, and maybe have an international Arab-Muslim peace force and training of Palestinian policemen so that the process of reconstruction is taking place. The trouble, of course, is how can you force Hamas to leave Gaza? How can you deprive them of the weapons?
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reports that Arab leaders are expected to approve a proposal to ask the UN to help set up a joint Arab international peacekeeping force to run Gaza during an interim period while a new Palestinian police force is trained and a group of technocrats runs the country. Egypt has refused to assume control over the territory it ruled from 1948 to 1967 when it was seized by Israel during the Seven-Day War. Arab League spokesman Jamal Rushdie tried to minimize disagreements over Egypt's Gaza plan while addressing Arab media. He says the plan to rebuild Gaza is just the beginning of a long road to reconstruct the territory and to secure the needed funds to do the rebuilding. Hamas has ruled out transferring power and says it will keep its arms, which its leaders call a red line or a line that it will not cross. Israel, in return, has threatened to resume hostilities, and Israeli media claims that Hamas has recruited more fighters, restoring its pre-conflict manpower to 30,000 men. Egyptian mediators have negotiated with Hamas without a great deal of success since it first grabbed control of Gaza in 2007, expelling the mainstream Fatah group and the Palestinian police force that was set up after Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
Palestinians fear hunger will stalk Gaza again this Ramadan after Israel stopped aid deliveries into the enclave due to a ceasefire standoff. Food prices soared, residents said, and aid officials warned Israel against using aid as a weapon of war. Lucy Fielder has more.
Gazans gather at a charity soup kitchen in Khan Yunis to receive Ramadan meals cooked by volunteers. Saturday was the first day of Ramadan. 2 days later, after Israel stopped aid deliveries to Gaza, organizers said they'd had to change the menu from meat to lentils because of price increases. Israel blocked the entry of aid trucks on Sunday as a standoff over Gaza's truce escalated. Humanitarian aid agencies warned Gaza's limited stockpiles of food, medicine, and shelter supplies may spoil. Volunteers at the kitchen, which provides meals for 20,000 people, feared food shortages. Here's organizer Abu Omar.
The kitchen administration prepared a plan for the month of Ramadan. But the closures of the crossings has disrupted all the plans because of the closure and the extremely high prices.
Hamas-run authorities deployed in local markets to question and detain merchants who put up their prices, according to Hamas sources and witnesses. Ayub Ma'aruf and his family broke their Ramadan fast on the rubble of their house in Jabalia, a sign of the desperate need Palestinians face after the 16-month-long war. Philippe Lazzarini, head of UN Palestinian Relief Agency UNRWA, said Israel's suspension of deliveries threatened lives and that aid and basic services, quote, must never be used as a weapon of war. More than 300 trucks were stopped from crossing the border from Egypt on Sunday, according to the International Federation of the Red Cross. While the Norwegian Refugee Council warned agencies could end up halting shipments of aid altogether, because keeping aid trucks waiting in queues is costly. Ma'aruf fears the return of the hunger they suffered in wartime.
We saw our children die at our feet and in front of our eyes, and we couldn't do anything for them. Because of the famine that we witnessed, we ate grass, we cooked grass, and ate it with spoons.
Israel, while announcing the aid suspension, said it will not allow a ceasefire without the release of all remaining hostages. Hamas has denounced Israel's move as blackmail and, quote, a blatant coup against the agreement.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting.
Our next guest says America is dangerously ignorant of what's going on in China. So for a look at the international exchange of academic and scientific ideas, I'm joined by Yanzeng Huang of the Council on Foreign Relations. His recent op-ed appears in the New York Times.
What is it that we don't know that we should?
Well, the problem is not that we don't have much information on China. The problem is that we don't have enough useful information on China, right? Certainly with the spread of social media, it's like we're overwhelmed by information from China.
Okay, but, so what do we need?
What we need is that I highlight the importance of doing more useful, interesting scholarly work on China that is become much a necessity given that the deteriorating of the U.S.-China relations, and the U.S. government, intelligence communities in particular, right, they are now facing an access problem in the country. I'm not saying, right, that the scholars should act like a proxy for the government agencies. I'm just saying, this actually highlights the importance, for scholarly research to inform what the government should do, like in terms of U.S.-China policy.
So in your article, you cite the COVID pandemic as sort of a turning point before which we had more access, more information, more of an exchange of people and ideas. What was different then? How were things better? And what did that yield for both the Chinese and the Americans?
Well, the good news is that, of course, when with the end of that zero COVID policy, right, the people allowed visit China in person, right, the scholars are able to return to China, right, conversation with Chinese counterparts. The problem is that they're acting much constrained here, right? It's now more difficult to do field work in the country. Simply just asking for one-on-one meeting with old friend there, can be a concern, because when I was there, you don't want to bother someone, what if that he would consider this is going to be a risk for him, so you don't want to cause trouble for you and your interlocutors, right? Accessing open source information can be also risky, right? That given, this new anti-espionage law, by which sort of broadened the scope of what counts as a national secret. Right?
It looks to many like the U.S. is becoming more and more isolationist from the rest of the world. Is that going to be a problem? Do you see it becoming a problem for science, for academics, for the growth of humankind?
Of course, I think that's not a good thing for the United States. It doesn't help project the U.S. soft power, right? It doesn't help expanding the U.S. influence. But I think the stake is more than that. If we remember, George Kennan said many, many years ago, right? When we talk about exchange, right, the people-to-people exchange, right? He was saying this is not just for the sake of diplomacy or international relation. It's good for America's own human development, right? Now he will just say, I don't care what the outside is doing or think about us. We're just going to make ourselves great again. Right? I don't think that is the right approach.
Yanzeng Huang is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor at Seton Hall University. Dr. Huang, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.